We now live in a world where everything costs more today than it did yesterday. A lot more. So this leads us to ask, how much more will our food cost tomorrow? And hey, will we be able to pay for it?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 596th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Longapo City who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, everyone.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
Folks, in 2006, which was like 2 years ago, I found myself driving west on Interstate 10 toward Flagstaff, Arizona, when, of a sudden, traffic came to a complete stop. After sitting in the car for a while, I thought I'd get out and stretch my legs and have a more intimate look at that beautiful Arizona desert. But what captured my attention was not the red rock formations that you see in the television commercials and the movies. It was the double line of idling trucks that stretched out in front of me toward the west for as far as I could see. Oh, there were a few of us cars sandwiched between those rumbling giants, but only a few of us. And then I got to thinking, what would happen if all those trucks were forced to stop for good? Well, of course, they eventually cleared some wreckage off the road up ahead, and all those trucks proceeded to deliver their goods to a hungry nation, and all is well. Or is it? They say food now travels an average of 1,500 miles from where it is grown to where it is consumed. In 2006, when that incident occurred on the highway, diesel cost over right about $1.50 a gallon. Today, diesel is somewhere in the neighborhood of $5 a gallon. That is a 300% increase in just 2 years. And so today we do ask, how much will our food cost tomorrow? And will we be able to pay for it? Here to help us explore this question, we have a couple of great people. Let's see, we'll start with Fred Magdoff. Fred is the Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont. Hello, Fred.
Good morning, Michael.
Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Hey, what kind of agriculture do they have in Vermont?
Well, a good part of the land area that's in agriculture is in dairy farms.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been certainly a tremendous growth in the number of small farms. Some of them are small organic dairies or with other animals like sheep for many of them are making milk and then cheese. And then we have a lot of small vegetable farms that have started as community-supported agriculture farms, CSAs, where mm-hmm. people buy shares in the farm. So there's been an explosion of interest in those smaller farms.
Wonderful. And we came across you through an article that you wrote called The World Food Crisis, Sources and Solutions. So you're a writer, a thinker, a professor emeritus, and the son of the famous Harry, right?
That is true.
Tell us about your dad a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, my father, who died just a couple of years ago in his mid-90s, had worked for many years during World War II in the Department of Commerce and other positions in the government. And then after that, he had been blacklisted during the McCarthy period, and then had a number of jobs, including he was on Wall Street for a while, a few other things, but as an economist. And then he eventually joined Monthly Review, the magazine that he co-edited for many years, which is an independent socialist magazine edited in New York. And he wrote a number of books, The Age of Imperialism, and about the U.S. economy, and stayed intellectually vibrant until pretty much the end. So we were pretty lucky. And
you're carrying on the family tradition, right?
Well, to a certain extent. Uh-huh. Going into agriculture wasn't exactly the family tradition. But, yes, as far as writing for Monthly Review and trying to get at some of the deeper issues facing the society in that sense, I'd say, I guess I am.
Well, in that respect, don't you think agriculture and food are great metaphors for discussing just about anything you want?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And with that, we'll introduce our next guest, Mark Nguyen, who is the author of Closing the Food Gap. Mark, welcome to The Food Chain.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Now, you're out there in Texas someplace today, right?
I'm somewhere south of Dallas in a truck stop, and your discussion of trucks is absolutely right on, especially for me. I'm watching them go by in endless numbers.
And it's just amazing how once you stop to look at them, and of course we usually don't, we just kind of take them for granted, you know, but that incident on the highway out there on Interstate 10 just kind of forced me, literally and figuratively, both to just stop and look. And the enormity of the amount of goods that are traveling around the country via trucks is just truly incredible. So, Mark, I met you at Pollinating Our Future, which is an urban agriculture conference in Milwaukee earlier this year, and became known to me as quite an organizer of community food systems, a participant in developing community food systems in Connecticut, I believe, right?
That's right. I mean, I want to go back to the trucks for a minute.
Okay, go ahead.
I got my start in the late 1970s when we had our first independent trucker strike. I don't know if you all remember that.
Yeah.
Maybe Fred does, but, you know, because of the rising price of diesel gas back then, we suddenly, you know, there was suddenly a slowdown on the part of those who were bringing our food from the West Coast to the Northeast. And we discovered for the first time, since we were at the end of the food chain, so to speak, how vulnerable we were and what the relation was between energy and food. And as a result, organizations like the one I ran for 25 years, the Hartford Food System in Hartford, Connecticut, began to spring up with the idea that we should start to rethink our whole food system and start to think regionally rather than nationally or even globally.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I guess it really does make sense to look at food as the metaphor for just about everything that happens in our world. You both of you do work with community food systems and feeding the hungry. You write about it. You work at it. What do you see happening out there in terms of people being able to buy food? You know, for many, many years, decades, we were told that, whether it was true or not, that we were fortunate because we have access to cheap food. But yet, that seems to be changing. What are you two seeing? Fred, let's start with you.
Well, I'd say it's changed dramatically. Even when food was, considered to be very cheap, not that many years ago, we still have many people in that country who were hungry. USDA would do surveys, the U.S. Department of Agriculture would do surveys every year, as would others. And over a period of maybe 10 or 15 years, almost every year there was a growing demand for food at food banks and the finding that there were more and more people that were hungry. And so many of them were working people who had jobs that just didn't pay enough, if they were making minimum wage or close to it, to pay everything they needed to live, the rent, heat, gasoline to get to work, the food, etc., electricity. What happened in the last year or so, a little over a year, it's really about getting close to 2 years, there's been a dramatic rise in the price of all the basic foods. And this has just played havoc with people's budgets, especially the lower down in the socioeconomic classes you go. And there's just an explosion of demand for food from charities of different types, either affiliated with churches or not, and they're not being able to meet all that demand. And it's not just the food that's the issue. It's the food and the energy, which, as Mark mentioned, are intimately intertwined in a number of ways. That is making things especially difficult for people. So this is, I mean, what's happening in the United States, of course, is relatively small compared to what's happening in the rest many other countries of the world.
Well, we'd like to pick that up when we come back from this short break. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We do have Mark Wynn, who's the author of Closing the Food Gap, Fred Magdoff, who is the Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science at the University of Vermont, and of course we have you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Question of the day, how much more will our food cost tomorrow, and will we be able to afford it? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back, please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, there's one thing for sure. Whatever we pay for food today is not going to be enough to pay for that food tomorrow. And so we wonder how much more will our food cost tomorrow, and will we, you and I, and our fellow citizens have enough money to pay for it? Mark Wynn, let's go back to you, author of Closing the Food Gap, thankfully calling in from a truck stop somewhere south of Dallas, out there on the great highways of America. Professor Fred Magdoff was telling us about what he sees happening out there, and he sees trouble. What do you see?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, to suggest that food prices are going to continue to climb, I can't imagine that anybody would argue about that right now. I mean, we've seen this pattern over the years of a sudden spike and followed by a decline, but still a continual rise in prices. Right now, we're seeing one of the worst increases we've seen in a very long time. And I think, you know, two things are going on. We have been dependent on a so-called cheap food policy for our whole lives, almost, or at least since World War II. That's been what we've tried to do. We've been able to do that as long as we've had cheap energy.
Cheap labor and cheap water.
Lots of other subsidies that our government provides. Through the Farm Bill process, I imagine many of your listeners are familiar with, you know, the sort of gross inequities we experience through disproportionate subsidies for commodity producers and very little public support for, you know, healthy food like fresh fruits and vegetables.
And none for me.
And none for you. And very little for me as well. And what really does concern me, however, is that there's a large and growing percentage of Americans who are, you know, can't afford any kind of food, let alone healthy food. As Fred pointed out, and I'm very honored the fact to be on the show with him. He's definitely one of my favorite professors. That the poor basically pay more. A poor family is paying about 15 to 20% of their annual income.
What do you mean the poor pay more? A greater percentage of their income?
They're paying a greater percentage of their income for food, 15 to 20%, whereas most of us are paying around 10%. And in addition, if you're living, as many poor people do, in so-called food deserts, they're shopping at places, or forced to shop at places that tend to be more expensive.
What's a food desert?
Food desert is a place that is usually lacking in any kind of affordable, high-quality supermarket, mm-hmm. or even farmers markets, or any kind of decent food retail, and often has a tremendous number of convenience stores and fast food restaurants. In other words, lots of unhealthy food, very little healthy food, and what is available tends to be rather expensive.
So in terms of nutrition then, what you're saying essentially is poor people pay a greater percentage of their income on food, and the food that they tend to get is much less nutrient dense, if you will, than food should be, and so that they're paying even more.
And partly because of our skewed farm policies that are skewed away from support for fresh fruits and vegetables, among other healthy foods. We've seen an actual price increase of up to 40% over the last 10 years or so in fresh fruits and vegetables, but an actual decrease of 10 to 15% for your sodas and fatty and sugary snack products. So we have this irony where those high-calorie, low-nutrient foods are less expensive, but the healthy, nutrient-dense foods are much more expensive, which is yet again another penalty on the poor.
Okay. Professor Magdoff, we were talking a little bit about this incredible inflation. Where is it coming from?
Well, certainly one of the major issues is energy, has been the increase in energy prices. Mm-hmm. And that affects agriculture in a number of ways. One is directly, it just costs more to do everything in agriculture because agriculture is very energy intensive, using a lot of energy not just to drive these humongous tractors and combines, but also to produce nitrogen fertilizer, which is very energy intensive. About a third of the energy that goes into growing an acre of corn out in the Midwest is actually just for the nitrogen fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And the pesticides, et cetera, that are used. So if energy prices go up, the cost of producing food in the traditional, this conventional way, that is, of our large-scale industrial agriculture goes up.
Boom.
But there's also now a whole different factor, and that is the diversion of some of our food into the fuel system. And in the United States, that's mainly corn being diverted into ethanol production. Last year, that is 2007, it was estimated that 20% of the entire corn crop in the United States was used to produce ethanol to be blended with gasoline. And so the demand for these food products or feed for animals, that's corn, soybeans, and when you get to Asia, the palm oil, in addition to other crops, means that as energy prices go up, the producing of alternative energies, biofuels or agrofuels, causes those products that they're based on to rise in price because it becomes economically worthwhile to use them to produce fuel instead of to use for food. So energy is tied both ways into it, and I think that's probably one of the largest drivers of what's happening, but there certainly are others.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask both of you about the impact of government-induced inflation. I recently read a story about Zimbabwe, and the story made mention of the fact that a loaf of bread there cost 2 billion Zimbabwe dollars. 2 billion. And I wonder what impact our governments have, you know, its efforts to rescue an economy from the housing bubble by, you know, printing cheap dollars. Is that having an impact on this as well?
I don't think so, Michael. I don't think that that's the real issue here. I think I think there's the energy. I think there's the issue that there are some countries that were formerly food self-sufficient that mm-hmm. now are importing food. There are people in China and Latin America that are wealthier, and they're eating more meat.
More protein.
So that, and so that the grains, corn and soybeans, are being diverted for animal feed. So I think there are a lot of reasons. I don't think it's the current economic crisis, except to the extent that there are people who are looking for places to make money.
Well.
And they have been using all sorts of gimmicks to make money that are not working for them right now. And so they have started speculating more in commodity markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so that we have, to a certain extent, a speculative boom. We don't know what percentage of our food prices are caused by that, by the buying of futures, buying in the futures market. But certainly some is, just like with oil. I think it's the same thing. So people who have been playing around in these markets, that I think these financial markets where they're just pushing around pieces of paper, gambling on really without anything of value underneath it, are now saying, well, wait a second, maybe the commodities markets are increasing dramatically. Why don't we own a piece of something real? And so there's been a lot of money poured over the last 6, 9, 10 months into the commodity markets, including corn, soybeans, wheat, etc.
Anything that has some reality to it.
Yeah.
When we get back, I want to ask both of you, start with Mark, what impact this is having on community food systems like food banks and whatnot. And that's something I believe Mark is really intimately connected with. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Mark Wynn, author of Closing the Food Gap, and Professor Emeritus Fred Magdoff, the University of Vermont. We're talking food, the future of our food. Will we have enough money to pay for it? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. We now live in a world where it costs a lot more today or tomorrow than it did today. A lot more. And this leads us to ask, how much more will our food cost tomorrow, and will we be able to pay for it? We're asking Mark Wynn, author of Closing the Food Gap, and Professor Fred Magdoff, University of Vermont, Professor Emeritus of Plant and Soil Science. Mark, how is this inflation, these rapidly rising prices of food and everything else for that matter, what impact is it having on our ability to feed the poor in our food programs like the one you administered?
It's having a dramatic impact. Our food banks are running out of food. We've had unprecedented food shortages at food banks. Keep in mind that a typical food bank is running a truck or several trucks almost around the clock, picking up food from all over their region, bringing it to the food bank, taking it to food to smaller sites.
So we're talking diesel here, aren't we?
Talking diesel. The food bank directors I talk to, they're paying double to three times for their fuel just to move food around than they were before. They're dependent on donations, and this is hurting them a lot. They're reducing their ability to feed people. On the other hand, programs like food stamps, which is by far our nation's largest food program, something in the order of $35 billion a year, you get a food stamp that a recipient is receiving today is basically the same amount as they received several months ago. They do adjust your benefits based on inflation, but they only do it once a year, and that is in October. So a summertime food stamp recipient is not getting as much value. In fact, they probably lost 5 to 10% of the value of their food stamps right now compared to what they might have received in, say, last November. And one other category that I'm even more concerned about are our school programs, our nation's school lunch and school meal programs. They're in the same boat. The amount of reimbursement they receive from the federal government, which actually feeds 60% of our school children in this country, has not increased with inflation either. So as September rolls around, August rolls around, schools reopen, school food service directors are going to have less money to buy food than they had last year in terms of, because of the impact of inflation.
So I guess in that respect, they're like all the rest of us, you know, because our incomes probably are not going up to the extent that inflation is going up. And so we're all kind of getting left behind. Professor Magdoff, are we going to have enough money in the future to pay for the food if it keeps going up like it is now?
You know, the near-term future is not good. I'm very concerned, especially in the northern regions, about what's going to happen this winter with people having to pay for fuel as well as food, fuel to heat their houses and food. We've had a long period of time when the wages of the average worker has not increased, certainly not with once you took sort of basic inflation into account. And we had a long period of time when the actual dollar amount of the minimum wage didn't increase at all. That just is changing now. But for many, many years, the purchasing power just went down and down and down. So I think it's going to be tough. I think what's happening is that everyone is, the truly wealthy people don't have to worry. Those that are in sort of the middle class are being a little more careful. And those who are near poor are having a difficult time making it. And those that are really poor are becoming destitute with regard to how do they pay all their bills and feed their families. So I see this as a huge moral and humane issue, which is at least in the short term just going to get worse.
Mark Wynn, do you share that pessimism there?
Yes. One thing I think, though, this crisis might lead us toward, and I think it's been part of the reason that we have a crisis as well today, is the resurgence in our regional food systems, that we might begin to start to think about our food supply as being generated more locally.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily mean, everybody is going to eat only food that's grown within, 50 miles of their home. But I do think that there's a huge opportunity to reinvest in our agriculture, both our land, our infrastructure, and our farmers, in regions that are closer to large populations. We've neglected that since World War II. We've gone to
Because we've had cheap food.
We've had cheap food, we've had cheap energy, we've had interstate highways that, make it easy to move food all over the country, and air and rail that have also made it inexpensive to move food all over the globe. Now chickens are coming home to roost. And the regional approach, and Fred mentioned at the beginning that Vermont has this really explosion in small farms and CSAs and the fastest CSAs and organic farming are among the fastest growing segments of agriculture in this country. We're up to 4,500 farmers markets across the country. In the 1970s, we didn't have more than a couple hundred. Those are all positive signs. Now, the concern is they're not going to scale up fast enough to help us with this crisis. And so I think that, the solution is going to be a way to start to scale that whole regional food system up with more government investment. And we did see some small but good news come out of the Farm Bill in that regard. There are some good opportunities to use money to support the development of regional agricultural infrastructure, of farmers markets, of CSAs, and even programs that are going to help low-income people participate in a regional food system as well.
I just got to thinking, do you think anybody really can put, really has a lot of faith in a food system that delivers food from a couple thousand miles away? That can you actually put your faith in something that's that complex?
Professor? Well, I've been doing it.
I'm sitting in this truck stop, and I just had a bottle. I got a bottle of water because I was parched, and I had to talk to all you guys. And it's Evian water with water from the French Alps sitting in Texas. And I'm saying, what did it cost to bring that French water to Texas? That's not a very rational system under any measure.
Going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to the phones, talk with Mike, who has a question about food and energy that perhaps you can answer for him. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the future of our food. You know, prices of energy are going up hugely. 2 years ago, the price of diesel was $1.50 a gallon. Today, it's somewhere around $5 per gallon. That's an increase of over 300%. In a couple of years. And you know, you extend that out and you wonder, how on earth are we going to be able to pay for our food? And I guess that's a question we're asking today, and we're asking it of you. The phone numbers are 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We have Professor Fred Magdoff, University of Vermont, Plant and Soil Sciences, Mark Wynn, author of Closing the Food Gap, and you right back. Well, one thing's for sure, we now live in a world where everything costs more today than it did yesterday. And not just a little more, but a lot more. And so we're asking today, will we have enough money to pay for that food tomorrow? And we have with us today Professor Fred Magdoff, who is the Plant and Soil Sciences at University of Vermont. We have Mark Wynn, author of Closing the Food Gap, and we have you. We're going to go to the phones now and talk first with Mike. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, hello, Michael.
Fire away.
Okay, I'm going to suggest that if the United States were to put a much greater emphasis on the production of sugar beets, that it would have the effect of bringing down both food and fuel costs. I think your experts there probably are aware of the fact that you can get almost five times the amount mm-hmm. of alcohol per acre with sugar beets as you can with corn, and that the byproduct of this is an excellent feed for all kinds of barnyard animals. Mm-hmm. So I think we could bring both the cost of fuel and food down by a much greater production of sugar beets, and I wonder what your guests think of
that. Well, let's fire that one to Professor Fred Magdoff, soil sciences guy. Professor Magdoff, what do you think? Is it sugar beets better than corn?
Well, sugar beets may be better than corn, but I think that it's not a good idea to be using. I don't think it's a good idea to be using agricultural land to grow fuel at this point. I think until we are able to feed all our people, and I would say that on a global basis, but also within the United States, that there shouldn't be land diverted for other purposes.
Can I ask you a weird question? Is it possible to feed all of our people? Or because if we feed all of our people, won't those people make more people? And we'll kind of...
Well, that's not how it usually works. Usually as people become more secure in their economic standard of living, they actually have fewer children, and
is something that's starting to happen in Mexico, I hear.
It's happening, I think, in many countries, but we have right now, the last numbers that the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN had that I looked at were 2004. Of course, things have changed some since then, but there was enough food to enough grain produced to feed much more than the 6 billion people that were in existence at that time. Of course, a lot of the grain was being used to feed animals, but that then went on to feed people. But so the food is there or can be there very easily. There's also the other issue. There are a number of issues with regard to ethanol. First off, with making ethanol out of corn grain, you may actually lose energy in the process, mm-hmm. that it may take more energy to grow the corn and process the corn and make the ethanol than you get out of it. Now, with sugar beets, it might be somewhat more favorable, but you still have a number of issues there. And one is there is pollution, water pollution and air pollution when you make the ethanol. And then there's air pollution from using the ethanol in your cars. You have volatile organic carbons which are released because of the ethanol.
So it's not really a clear one way or another. Perhaps he's right, but there are a lot of other issues that have to be considered then, too. Let's go quickly to Rory, who has some ideas.
Hang on, Puncher.
Rory, welcome to the food chain.
Yeah, Mike, thanks for having me.
Sure.
The quickest way to fix this problem is to get at our domestic oil supply and do it quickly with PERSIF, and that will get the world markets aware that we're serious about solving our own energy issues. And that, in turn, will begin to moderate the price of energy, which will begin to moderate the price of food. And I think that is the quickest, smartest way to do it. I'm just curious as to what your guests think.
Okay, Mark, let's start with you.
I don't claim to be an energy expert, but common sense seems to suggest to me that, you know, that every measure to conserve ought to be explored. As I said before, I'm sitting at a truck stop in Texas, surrounded by SUVs.
Drinking Evian.
Drinking Evian water that was shipped here from France. And, you know, there's a lot of irrationality in just about everything we do with respect to energy in this country. So I'm a major advocate for conservation, and I think that somehow that's a dirty word.
Hey, what if we did both? What if we got new supplies and conserved what we had?
That would be fine, but I do think we have this, you know, we're always sort of looking for the magic bullet. You know, we're looking for the next great breakthrough in alternative energy or something else. And I'm all for pursuing those, and when we think we have something, let's invest in it. But in the meantime, the fastest way to at least mitigate the impact of this energy crisis is through conservation.
Okay, Rory?
I agree with Mark.
I think that our...
Oh, just a sec. Let's go ahead to
the professor.
I agree wholeheartedly with what Mark just said. I think the major failing that we've had in this country, since many people saw this coming, we actually saw a previous version of this, as Mark was talking about earlier in the 1970s, that conservation is really the key, and there are alternative energy sources. T-Bone Pickens now is very much into the T-Bone Pickens.
Mr. Oil himself is now into
into wind energy, as is Al Gore, and I think solar energy will be better. It would come down in price even more, and I think there will be alternatives. I wouldn't suggest going out and drilling all over the place for oil, which is only going to have an effect if it has any effect.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break here. I think Mark's going to have to take off. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Fred.
All right, and we will be right back with the professor. And, hey, by the way, I'm into wind energy because I am on radio, and you are too. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, what do you think out there? Are you and I going to have enough money to pay for our food in the future? Because whatever we pay in the future is going to be a lot more than we pay today. Or is our wages somehow going to keep up with that incredible inflation that's going on? Who knows? We're here with Professor Fred Magdoff, University of Vermont. Professor Magdoff, we're going to go quickly to the phones, but I'd like to ask you, is there something, many of your writings deal with helping poor people and whatnot, or reaching down to the poorer spectrums of society, is there something we can do to help poor people become more independent of our need, of their need for help? What can we do to help them become more independent?
Well, Michael, it's not a simple answer, but certainly in this situation, we could help with intensively areas where there is land available to help people garden. Mm-hmm. That's certainly one thing that has happened here, and probably in other places in the country too. But I think poverty is, I would say, is a part of our society which will never go away, and it's not the fault of the people who are poor. It's the way the society works. And so my own opinion
is that we need to say that people have a right to food. And this is something, by the way, that that Franklin Delano Roosevelt suggested in a in his one of his speeches to Congress, that people have certain economic rights. And I would say among those economic rights should be a right to food, an adequate diet for them and their family. And so I think there are things that can be done to help the poor. I don't see how we're going to get poor people less needy, if you will, of assistance, because the society that we live in creates this poverty as part, as it works. It creates great wealth, but at the same time, it creates a certain segment of a society which will be poor. And I would say it needs those people in order to work certain types of jobs. Mm-hmm. And so if that is the case, then it seems to me it's society's role to guarantee these people at least an ability to feed themselves and their families.
Okay, with that, we're going to go to the phones and talk with Scott, who has a question or a comment.
Michael and Professor.
Go ahead.
During the Depression, my wife's great-grandfather started a very successful commune in Los Angeles. There was no money involved. People worked and received plenty of food in exchange, but the government shut them down because they were worried about its communist implications. But could a communal farm work for us today? And also, if so, would the information in the book Metro Farms be able to help us accomplish that?
Huh. Well, Professor, can a communal farm work today?
I think it can. I'm sure there are some out there. There were quite a number during the, if we call them, hippie days
mm-hmm.
of the late 60s and maybe early 70s.
I don't remember any of those days. Do you?
I was out of the country for some of them. Maybe that's why I remember them. If you remember
them. Well, Professor, we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for your calls out there. Wish we had much more time, but we don't. This has been The Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.